The Distaff side of the Codrington family filled the front pew. Clinton Codrington faced them from the pulpit. Ralph was between the twins. There had been a brief but ferocious competition between Victoria and Elizabeth to decide who should sit closest to him. Apart from the family, there was nobody else in the church, and Victoria saw his glance and explained to Ralph in a penetrating whisper, "King Ben won't let any of his people come to our church." "King Loban Gula," Selina corrected her sweetly. "Not King Ben." Despite the full attendance, Clinton delayed the commencement of the evening service, finding and losing his place in the Book of Common Prayer half a dozen times, and glancing repeatedly towards the rear of the tiny church. From this quarter there was a sudden commotion. A small retinue of Matabele women had arrived outside the church. Clearly they were servants, house slaves and ladies-in-waiting to the imposing female figure in their midst. She dismissed them with a royal gesture and came in through the doors of the church. Every one of the Codringtons turned their heads and their faces lit with pleasure. The way in which this matron paced majestically down the aisle left not a doubt as to her high breeding and her place in the aristocracy of Matabeleland. She wore bangles and bracelets of beaten red copper, strings of highly prized samsam beads that only a chief could afford. Her cloak was of a beautifully tanned leather, ornamented with feathers of the blue jay and worked with designs of chipped ostrich shell. "I see you, Namuza," she declared. Her huge naked breasts shone with an ointment of fat and red clay. They pushed out ponderously from under her tanned cloak and dangled weightily to the level of her navel. Her arms were thick as a grown man's thigh, and her thighs as thick as his waist. There were rolls of fat around her belly, and her face was a black full moon, the glossy skin stretched tightly over her abundant flesh. Her merry eyes sparkled from between creases of fat, and her teeth flashed like the sunlit surface of a lake as she smiled. All this size was evidence to the world of her station, of her amazing beauty, of her fecundity. It was also unassailable proof of the high regard of her husband, of his prosperity and importance in the councils of Matabeleland. "I see you, Gelchild of Mercy," she smiled at Robin. "I see you, Juba, little dove," Robin answered her. "I am not a Christian," Juba intoned. "Let no evil one bear false tidings to Loban Gula, the black and mighty elephant." "If you say so, Juba," Robin answered primly, and Juba pinioned her in a vast embrace, while at the same time she called to Clinton in the pulpit. "I see you also, Chlopi. I see you, Whitehead. But do not be deceived by my presence here. I am not a Christian." She drew an elephantine breath and went on. "I come merely to greet old friends, not to sing hymns and worship your God. Also, I warn you, Chlopi, that if you read the story tonight of a man called the Rock, who denied his God three times before the call of the cock, I shall be displeased." "I shall not read that story," Clinton answered, "for by now you should know it by heart." "Very well, Chlopi. Then let the singing begin." And led by Juba in a startlingly clear and beautiful soprano, the entire Codrington family rollicked into the first verse of Onward Christian Soldiers, which Robin had translated into the Matabele vernacular. After the service, Juba bore down on Ralph. "You are Henshaw?" she demanded. "Inkosikasi," Ralph agreed, and Juba inclined her head to acknowledge the correct style of address to the senior wife of a great chief that Ralph had employed. "Then you are the one whom Batso, my firstborn son, calls brother," Juba said. "You are very skinny and very white, little hawk, but if you are Batso's brother, then you are my son." "You do me a great honour, Umame," Ralph said, and Juba took him in those mammoth arms. She smelled of clarified fat and ochre and wood smoke. But the embrace was strangely comforting, not at all unlike the feeling, only half remembered, that he had once experienced in Aletta's arms. The twins knelt side by side at the low truckle cot, both in long nightdresses, their hands clasped before their eyes, which were so tightly closed that they seemed to be in pain. Selina, also in her nightdress, stood over them to supervise the last prayer of the day. "Gentle Jesus, meek and mild." Kathy was already in her own bed, hair ribboned for the night, writing the day's entry into her diary by the light of the guttering candle made from buffalo fat and clothwick. "Pity my simplicity," gabbled the twins at such a speed that it came out as "pretty mice and pretty me." Arriving at the Amen in a dead heat, the twins leapt into the bed that they shared, pulled the blanket to their chins, and watched with fascination as Selina began to brush her hair, 100 strokes with each hand, so that it rippled and flamed with white fire in the candlelight. Then she came to kiss them, blew out the candle, and the thongs of her bed squeaked from across the small thatched hut as she climbed into it.
"Lena," whispered Victoria, "Vicky, go to sleep. Just one question, please." "All right, then, just one. Does God allow a girl to marry her own cousin?"
The silence that followed the question seemed to hum in the darkened bedroom like a copper telegraph wire struck by a sword. Kathy broke the silence.
"Yes, Vicky," she answered quietly. "God does allow it. Read the table of kindred and affinity on the last page of your prayer book."
The silence was contemplative now.
"Lena, Lizzie, go to sleep. You allowed Vicky to ask a question."
"All right, then, just one.
Does God get cross if you pray for something just for yourself, not for Daddy or Mummy or your sisters, but just for you alone?"
"I don't think so." Selina's voice was becoming drowsy.
"He might not give it to you, but I don't think he'll be cross. Now, go to sleep, both of you."
Kathy lay very still, on her back with her hands clenched at her sides, staring at the lighter oblong across the hut where the moon defined the single window.
"Please, God," she prayed, "let him look at me the way he looks at Selina. Just once, please."
"What do you think of Zuga's boy?" Robin took Clinton's arm as they stood together on the darkened stoop and looked out at the star-pricked black velvet curtain of the African night.
"He's a powerful lad, and I don't mean merely muscle." Clinton took his pipe from between his teeth and peered into the bowl. "His wagon is loaded with cases, long wooden cases from which the markings have been burned with a hot iron."
"Guns?" Robin asked.
"I think so."
"There is no law against trading guns north of the Limpopo," Robin reminded him. "And Lobengula needs all the power he can get to defend himself."
"Still, guns. I mean, it does go against the grain." Clinton sucked at his pipe, and each puff of smoke he exhaled was denser and ranker.
They were both silent for a while.
"He has a hard and ruthless streak, like his father," Robin judged at last. "A man needs that to survive in this land."
Robin shivered suddenly and hugged her own arms.
"Are you cold?"
Clinton was immediately solicitous.
"No. A grey goose walked over my grave. Let's go off to bed."
"A moment longer, Clinton. The night is so beautiful." Clinton put his arm about her shoulders.
"Sometimes I am so happy that it frightens me," he said. "So much happiness cannot go on forever."
His words seemed to precipitate the thick but formless dread that had hung over Robin all this day like the pall of smoke above the winter bush fires. It weighed her down with the premonition that something had changed in all their lives.
"May God save us all," she whispered.
"Amen to that," said Clinton as softly, and took her in out of the night.
The interior of the thatched hall was domed and darkened, so that the patterns of latticed branches and lovingly knotted bark rope disappeared into the gloom above their heads like the arches of a medieval cathedral. The only light was from the small fire on the clay hearth in the centre of the floor. One of the king's wives threw another handful of dried herbs upon it, and oily blue tendrils of smoke twisted upwards towards the unseen roof. Across the fire, on a low platform of dried clay covered with a thick mattress of furs, silver-backed jackhorn and blue monkey, bat-eared fox and spotted civet, sat the king. He was a mountainous figure, stark naked, and his skin polished with fat so that he gleamed like an enormous Buddha carved from a solid block of washed anthracite. His head was round as a cannonball, surmounted by the Induna's ring. His arms were massive, bulging with fat and muscle, but the hands in his lap were strangely dainty, narrow across the pink palms, with long tapered fingers. His trunk was thickened, his breasts pendulous. All this was flesh which he had carefully cultivated. The beer pots and beef dishes stood close at hand. The thick millet beer bubbled softly, and the cuts of beef each had a thick rind of yellow fat. Every few minutes one of his wives responded to a nod or a small movement of one graceful hand by proffering a dish. Weight and size were the mark of a king. Not for nothing was Lobengula called the great black elephant of Matabeleland. His manner was slow, imbued with the vast dignity of his size and rank. Yet his eyes were thoughtful and deeply intelligent. His features, despite the burden of fat which blurred them, were handsome, lacking outward traits of the hideous cruelties which any Matabele king had to make part of his life. "My people expect me to be strong and harsh. There are always those who look for the smallest weakness in me, as the young lions watch the black-maned leader of the pride," Mzilikazi had explained to his son. "See how my chickens follow me to be fed." He had pointed with the toy spear of kingship at the high wheel of tiny specks turning slowly in the sky above the hills of Tabas in Dunas. "Where my vultures desert me, I will be as dust." Lobengula, his son, had learned the lesson well, but it had not brutalized him. Indeed, there was a line to his mouth that was almost diffident, and a shadow behind the light of intelligence in his eyes that was hesitant, the confusion of a man tugged at by too many currents and winds, a man caught up by his destiny, and uncertain as to how he could break away from its remorseless toils. Lobengula had never expected to take up his father's spear of kingship. He was never the heir apparent. There had been older brothers from mothers of higher rank and nobler blood. He stared now across the fire at the man that squatted there, a magnificent warrior, his body tempered to black steel by long marches and savage warfare, his understanding and compassion expanded by close and intimate daily contact with common men, his courage and loyalty proven to all the world 10,000 times, so there could be no doubts, not even in his own midnight watches, which is the time of doubts. And Lobengula found himself longing to rid himself of this fearsome burden of kinship and place it on the other man's shoulders. He found himself wishing for that quiet and secret cave in the Matopas Hills where he had known the only happy days of his life. The man opposite him was a half-brother, his bloodline, like that of Lobengula himself, reaching back unsullied to the Dzanzi of Zululand. He was a prince of the House of Kumalo, wise and brave and untroubled by doubts. "Such a one should have been king," Lobengula thought, and his love for his half-brother choked his throat so that he coughed. He moved one little finger, and a wife held the beer pot to his lips, and he swallowed once, and then signed for it to be taken away. "I see you, Gundang." His voice was throaty and low, the sadness still in it, for he knew that he could not escape that way. He felt like a man on a solitary journey through the forest where the lions are hunting. His recognition released Gundang from his respectful silence. The Induna clapped his hand softly and began to recite his half-brother's ritual praises, and Lobengula's mind wandered back across the years. His earliest memory was of the road, the hard road up from the south, driven by the mounted men dressed all in brown, riding brown ponies. He remembered the popping sound of the guns, which he learned only later to fear, and the smell of gun smoke, spicy and sour, as the wind brought it down to where he clung to his mother. And he remembered the wailing of the women as they mourned the dead. He remembered the heat and the dust, trotting naked as a puppy at his mother's heels. How tall she had seemed, the muscles of her back gleaming with sweat, and Ninji, his sister, in the sling upon her hip, clinging to one of his mother's fat, jostling breasts, with mouth and tiny, determined fists. He remembered toiling up the stony hills with his father's single wagon, rolling and pitching along ahead of them. On it rode Mzilikazi's senior wife and her son, Unkulumani, 3 years older than Lobengula and heir apparent to the kingship of the Matabele. They were the only ones who did not walk. He remembered how his mother's back had withered, the beautiful gleaming skin becoming loose and baggy, the rib cage beginning to show through as the famine wasted her substance, and Ninji screaming with hunger as the rich, creamy flow from her teats dried up. This was where the memory of Sala began. It was mixed up at first with the shouting and singing as a band of raiding Matabele returned to the fleeing column. He had first seen Sala in the firelight as the warriors slaughtered the captured cattle, and Lobengula could almost still feel the hot grease and the bloody juices of the beef running down his chin and dripping onto his naked chest as they feasted, breaking the long days and months of starvation on cattle taken from the white men, the Buni. Once his belly was bulging tightly with meat, Lobengula had joined the circle of curious Matabele princelings and princesses who surrounded the captives. But he had stood back from the teasing and jeering and prodding of the other children. Sala was the eldest of the two little girls. It was only long afterwards that Lobengula learned that her name was Sarah. But even now he could not pronounce that sound. The Matabele raiding party had surprised a small caravan of Boer wagons and had killed everybody except these two small white children. Her whiteness was the first thing that had struck Lobengula. How white her face was in the firelight, as white as an egret's wing. And she had not wept as her younger sister wept. After that, the memories grew stronger. Sala walking ahead of him, as the slow column wound through thick thorn forest. Sala taking the infant Ninji from his mother when she slipped and fell with weakness in the black mud of the swamps while the mosquitoes formed a dark, whining cloud over them. Exactly where Sala's little sister died, Lobengula could not recall. It might have been in the swamps. They left her small, naked white body unburied, and the column marched on. At last, Lobengula's own mother fell and could not rise again, and with her last strength handed little Ninji to Sala. Then she curled up quietly and died. All the weak ones died like that, and their infants died with them, for no other woman would take the orphans, for each of them had their own infants to care for. However, Sala strapped little Ninji on her own thin white back in the way that the Matabele carry their babies. Then she took Lobengula's hand in hers, and they toiled on after the fleeing nation. By now, Sala's clothing had long ago fallen off her thin white body, and she was as other Matabele girls who had not yet reached puberty, completely naked. She had half forgotten her own language, and spoke only the language of the tribe. The sun had darkened her skin, and the soles of her bare feet had grown a thick covering, hard as rhinoceros skin, so she could march over razor flint and needle thorns. Lobengula came to love Sala, transferring everything he had ever felt for his mother to her, and she stole extra food for him and protected him from the bullying of his older brothers, from Nkululami, the cruel one, and from Nkulumani's mother, who hated all that might one day stand in the way of her son's claim to the kingship of the Matabele. Then the Matabele crossed the Limpopo, the river of crocodiles, and the land beyond was fair, thick with game and running with sweet rivers. The wandering nation followed Mzilikazi into the magical hills of the Matopos. There, on a lonely hilltop, the king met the wizard of the Matopos, face to face. Mzilikazi saw fire spring up at the Amlimo's bidding, and he heard the spirit speak from the very air about the Amlimo. 100 different voices. Voice of infant and crone, of man, of beast, the cry of the fish eagle, the snarl of the leopard. And from that day the Amlimo had the reverence and superstitious awe of the king and all his people. The Amlimo pointed the way north again, and as the Matabele emerged from the broken hills of the Matopos, they saw spread before them a beautiful land, rich with grass and tall trees. "This is my land," said Mzilikazi, and built his kraal under the hills of the Indunas. However, the Matabili had lost nearly all their cattle, and many of the women and children had died on that cruel journey northwards.